Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Rituparna Patki. Today, I'm going to be in conversation with Trina Nilina Banerjee. Trina Nilina Banerjee is an assistant professor in cultural studies at the Center for Studies in Social Sciences, Calcutta. For her PhD, she worked on a history of women in the group theatre movement in Bengal between 1950 and 1980. She has also been researching the interfaces between women's movements and political theatre in contemporary Manipur for several years now. Her essays and reviews on these and other subjects have appeared in national and international journals, as well as in several edited volumes. Between 2011 and 2013, she taught at the Theatre and Performance Studies Department at the School of Arts and Aesthetics at JNU. Her research interests include gender, performance, political theatre, theories of the body, post-colonial theatre, and South Asian history. She has also been a theatre and film actress, as well as a journalist and fiction writer. Her book, Performing Silence, Women in the Group Theatre Movement in Bengal, was published by the Oxford University Press, India, in October 2021. This is the book that we will primarily be talking about today. Trina, I'm so glad to have you with us and welcome to this interview.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here as well and to be talking to you about the book.
Right. So let me begin by asking you about the inspiration behind writing this book, because your bio just mentions that you are also a theatre and film actress and you've worked on the theatre movement in Bengal.
I think it was more a compulsion than an inspiration, really, because I do write about this briefly in the preface, and I'm not sure I had the clarity when I began to work on this. But I do write about this in my preface, that I grew up pretty much in the theater, in the sense, sometimes literally and, you know, in a broader sense, metaphorically, because both my parents were in the group theater movement. That's how they met. They met in the theater as well. So my father was a theater director. My mother was both a professor of comparative literature and an actress. So unlike many other schoolmates that I had, I had a sort of intimate knowledge of what the theater was as an audience, but also someone who kind of knew the insides of it, watched rehearsals, sat in auditoriums, etc., etc. And that was really a fascinating world for me. But I don't think I realized the compulsion to write about it until much later, and I wasn't even sure what form that was going to take, because I was an English literature student. I finished my master's at Jadavpur University in Calcutta, and then I got a scholarship to go to Oxford to study for a Master of Studies, and I was still doing English literature. In fact, my dissertation in Oxford was about modernism and empire in 20th century English literature. I was looking at Virginia Woolf. I was looking at Jean Rhys. I had absolutely nothing to do with the theater so far as my academic work was concerned. But once I came back from that and I was thinking of applying for my PhD to the US, something happened in the in between, which is that I had really missed doing theater when I was away. And I think there was some impulse in me to somehow bring my life as a theater practitioner, as and I was quite actively an actress at that time, and my work in the group theater and my academic work face to face with each other. And I think that was, and I felt like there was some kind of a deep division between what I had grown up with and what my experience of the world was and what I was working on. So I felt that somehow I needed to bring that together. So that's when I began my PhD on this, and it was the PhD which has turned into the book.
Right. So in your book, you do mention that you focus on the period between 1950 to 1980. So if you could, explain the reasoning behind it.
Well, the first marker is easy to see why that's the marker, but actually the book begins a little earlier. It begins in the 1940s, and that's kind of, I say this in the book as well, it's kind of the framing or the prehistory of the group theatre movement in Bengal, which is that I look at the Indian People's Theatre Association, which, as you know, in the years just preceding independence, was very strongly active in Bengal. So it begins with looking at the work of the Indian People's Theatre Association. It looks at the various paradigms, political, aesthetic, organizational, that determine the functioning of the IPTA in Bengal in those years, but not just in Bengal. The IPTA was a national organization in a very, very active sense at that point of time. And it also looks at the ways in which, as a political organization, as a sort of embodiment of the cultural vanguard, the kind of energies and the kind of sort of fundamental problems that it encounters in the 1940s. And I argue that many of these modes of operation, many of these, both these energies and inspirations, as well as these problems, persist in the way the group theater fashions itself in the years that come. So the IPTA splits in Bengal in the late 40s. And it is from this split that the first theater group in Bengal, the first active group theater in Bengal, emerges. But it's not even about a question of direct lineage or whether the members themselves in these group theaters later were part of IPTA at some point or the other. But the question was far more whether there was a certain driving imperative, a certain kind of ideological framework that continued in many of the groups that kind of emerged as theater groups in the 1950s in Bengal. So I look at the 40s and the early 50s because of that. And of course, everyone knows that the IPTA was an entirely new mode of operation, of actually making theater and producing theater and performing theater, very different from the commercial theater of Bengal at that time, or all over India. It was an entirely different mode of thinking about theater, thinking about art, in fact. And there are also very, very clear reasons why the book kind of ends in the 70s, even though in the conclusion I talk a lot about what happens in the next two decades, I try to sort of mark some of the very strongly emerging trends and tendencies that determine where theater goes in the 80s and 90s. But it stops, actually technically in 1977, the last chapter before the epilogue and conclusion, for two or three reasons. The first, of course, is that the last chapter deals with a production that was staged in Bengal, in Calcutta, in the years of the national emergency, so between 1975 and 1977. But 1977 is also the year where it's not just the year that the emergency ends and the elections are held in India. It's also the year that the left front government comes to power in Bengal. And I argue that after the left front comes to power, the relationship of political theater in Bengal, especially most of political theater in Bengal, was left oriented at that point of time, oriented towards some color of a leftist ideology. The relationship of this political theater to the state, to institutional frameworks of the government changes, because the new government is in many ways positively orientated towards these theatre groups. So there is much more sort of patronage and support from the stage to the groups who are of the same ideological, color often. But even if it isn't so, there is a certain kind of state support which was missing in the earlier years, where there was a far more antagonistic relationship between these groups and the state. That was one reason. So I felt that the particular political relationship of the groups to the state changes, and it would require different tools to understand this new sort of cultural formation. That's one. The other is from the 80s onwards, you have the immense popularity of Doordarshan as a medium, which again changes the modes in which the theatre would relate to the spectators. What kind of spectators come? What is the popularity of the theatre? What other options are available to the audiences? But also, interestingly, from the 80s onwards, you have more women in roles that were not so frequent for them in the decades preceding, which is that there were many more women now directing plays. Many more women slowly, many more as in, I mean, perhaps the first few women who are emerging as leaders and organizers of groups, the creative heads of theatre groups. And also from the 80s onwards, the feminist question is articulated, I feel, much more strongly for itself. The feminist question is articulated in the theatre in its own interest, per se, as feminist questions, which was not, I think, that strongly articulated in the years that had preceded. So, and of course, from the 90s onwards, like I say, even in the preface to the book, everything changes. The turn towards liberalization is taken, the market changes entirely, you have satellite television, you have different kinds of funding opportunities, you have a whole world of a new kind of capital that opens up. And I think the moorings of this group theatre, the modes of it or of its organization inevitably change post 1990s. I've said all this, briefly in the conclusion, but I had a very strong sense that things are very, very different from the 80s onwards. So I didn't want to, and it would require a completely different kind of approach and analysis. So I didn't venture beyond 1980.
Right. So, you also use a lot of archives in your research. So if you could talk about the importance of archives, as well as some of the other research methods that you have used in this work. And the second part of the question is for you to also talk about some of the challenges that you may have faced methodologically, because it really helps budding researchers.
Right. So one of the major points that I've tried to address in the introduction when I talk about these questions that you just asked is that when you're doing performance history, and there are very many different kinds of complexities. So for me, one of the major sort of limitations of the period that I was studying is that you were limited by the kinds of sources that are available, in the sense that you can't actually... So in performance studies, and especially in performance history, live performance is everything. I mean, theoretically as well, a lot of performance studies is based on the assertion that the live performance cannot, in fact, be discursively translated into text, into analysis. The live performance has its own kind of ontological status. This is something I've also discussed in the introduction. So therefore, because you're writing about a period, and this is true of a lot of theater history and a lot of performance history, that you do not have access to the live performance as such, except perhaps in very rare cases as audio recordings, in most cases through photographs in the periods that I was looking at, and mostly then through anecdotal history. And this was very important. The fact that one was actually looking at stories about the theater. So what you had was then a sort of a range of textual sources, for example, the reviews of the plays that you were, or the productions that you were discussing, the texts of the plays themselves. In what has been really, really important for me is the writing of the actresses that I was writing about, their own writing, their sort of scattered reminiscences, their interviews, in the case of Kea Chakraborty, her critical essays, her fiction, her own sort of analytical arguments around what she felt about the theater at the time. All this was extremely important. So, and not just the actresses themselves, but people around them, people who saw the plays, the people who had memories of the place. So a lot of this was actually, in fact, my archive, that which was published, but also listening to people, everyone, but people who were, you know, for example, one of the chapters in the book talk about a production of Doll's House by Shombhu Mitra. And there, if you read the book, you'll see that what was crucial to that analysis was a conversation with Professor Shomik Bondopadhyay, who also writes the foreword to the book, who was actually one of the in the audience when the play was first produced. And it was through my sort of interview with Shomikta that I got a sense of what the play was actually doing in performance, which was impossible to understand from published text of Putul Khela, which was a sort of an adaptation by Shombhu Mitra of Ibsen's Doll's House. So in a sense, this was anecdotal. You know, this was anecdotal. This was in fact a story told about watching a performance, but it gave me a crucial perspective on, in fact, the set design of the play, which had a particular kind of political impact on the performance text, which was impossible to discern from the published text itself. So then a lot of these were, these memories of people watching performances actually became important in my work. But besides this, of course, literally archives, the Natoshot archives were actually invaluable, where I found a lot of material on many of my chapters. But I also worked briefly at the PC Joshi archives in JNU, where also for the initial chapters I found some material. Methodologically, I think for me it was very important to ground my chapters in the social and historical context of the decades that I was talking about. So I looked at a lot of material. For example, in the third chapter, there's a lot of talk about the state of unemployment in India and Bengal at that time, because I was trying to understand what, in fact, women's labor meant at that time. So I read a lot of essays that were to do with economics, that were to do with actually, the sort of the census around unemployment in education at the time, in order to ground that essay in a certain kind of social and historical reality, which was important to me. But it was also very, very productive for me to actually do a close reading of not just the place that I was interested in, but also the memoirs and sort of autobiographies, you know, and reminiscences that I found of the actresses themselves. But then I also did things that were quite eccentric in that in two chapters, I read two different films. Like, for example, in the second chapter, I was reading Hrithik Ghatak's Komal Gandhar, because Komal Gandhar depicts a theater group. Even though it's coming out in the early 60s, it depicts a theater group that obviously carries Ghatak's own memories of the Indian People's Theater Association. And I was able to read, in a sense, the ideological space within which the theater group becomes a microcosm for an alternative vision of the nation through that film. So in that sense, it was very, very relevant to the questions I was asking. In the third chapter, I do a very sort of a brief but very detailed reading of Satyajit Ray's Mohanagar, because I felt that that was one of the films in the 60s where the question of women's labor once again was absolutely in the forefront and dealt with brilliant irony and kind of astuteness by Ray. So that was, so I spent some time analyzing two films because I thought both the films shed a certain light on the themes that I was interested in.
Right. Now, in this book, Performing Silence, you actually talk about gender in a multifaceted way. So, you know, what do you mean by that?
Right. So I wanted to make it very clear right at the beginning that I was not at least I wasn't intending to only write about what women were doing in the group theater. I wanted to make it very clear that I was writing, yes, so this is what I say in the introduction, and it's important, which is that, yes, I am interested in writing a political history of women in the group theater movement, which I tried to do, which is why I said I try to ground it in the social and historical reality of the decades I'm writing about. I try to ground where these women are coming from, what lives they're living, what is happening in the world around them, because this is very much a political theater movement. And these are political actors in that they choose to be in this movement. These women are, in fact, deeply political in their very different and rich ways. But I was also interested in writing a gendered history of the politics of the group theater movement, which based, these are two different things. To say that I am interested in writing a political history of the women means I'm interested in the women and the politics that and of the lives that they're living, the ideologies that determine their reality, a certain kind of materialist reading of their sort of quotidian reality. But I was also deeply interested. I had a very strong sense that I would not be able to, that was not enough. I wanted to do something else, which was also to actually look at the ideological structures, driving forces, the frameworks, and even the confusions of the movement as a whole, and see how these sort of ideological structures were in fact gendered. So, and here I was drawing very, very directly from Joan Scott's idea of the importance of using gender as an analytical category, like as an instrument of analysis, like as a lens. So in that sense, what is Joan Scott suggesting? She's suggesting that it's not enough to talk about women. Not all women's history is feminist history. To write a certain kind of feminist history or feminist analysis of anything is to be able to use gender as an analytical lens, which basically means that even when women are not being apparently being discussed, not being, you know, not the subject of discussion, so to say, they are not as in it's the woman's question is not at the center of the discussion, even then, many modes of political subjectivity, various different ways in which politics is done and understood and talked about are in fact gendered. Right. So even when we talk about, say, for example, when we talk about political prowess or efficacy in the political world, even now, it was much more common before, but even now in the politically correct world that we live in, at least within certain classes, it's very, very common to see political prowess and efficacy as a certain kind of masculinity, a certain kind of machismo even. So even when a woman is effective politically, one often sees that power in terms of a certain kind of effective masculinity, right? So the woman becomes a certain kind of an honorary man. So and there are numerous examples of this. I mean, at the time of Indira Gandhi, she was called, and I write about this, she was called the only real man in the Congress. Now, what is going on there? There is a way in which masculinity per se is valorized as powerful, and to be a woman is sort of automatically devalued as weak or ineffective, etc. So this is a way in which political language is gendered. I just give one example here. But the thing is, so I wanted to write a gendered history of the politics of the movement. So what was the gendering of the ideas that were being propagated, the ideas that were one was aspiring towards as a group theater activist. So therefore, a lot of my concern is with, for example, in one of the chapters, I do spend a long time discussing modes of masculinity or the ways in which heroic nationalist masculinity frames itself. And in relation to this masculinity, how is the woman conceived? I also discuss in the chapter on the modes of two contesting modes of revolutionary masculinity that struggle in his own plays. And these are very, very interesting and important questions, because you cannot understand the gendered politics of a movement as a whole unless you in fact look at the movement by using gender as an analytical category and instrument. And in that sense, both men and women are important within that structure. It's not enough to say you're just looking at women, even though the title talks just about women. There's more there.
Right. So in conjunction, I would also want to know about some of the major analytical frameworks as well as themes that you use in the book.
Right, so I've already talked about some, we've covered some, for me, for example, I was very clear that I was, even though I don't know if I say this kind of in so many words in the book, I was doing a feminist history, of course, but I was also doing I feel I'm deeply committed to historical materialism in the sense that I felt in every chapter that I needed to ground, like I said, the book in the historical reality of the time as far as I could, and then ask questions that went further. But I was, for example, deeply, I don't know if I'll be able to enumerate all my questions here, but analytical frameworks here, but I was deeply concerned throughout the book with the question of labor. How do you understand artistic labor? What is the status of women's artistic labor or the labor of a full-time actress in the theater, which is a non-remunerative art practice, with the larger sort of structures of the society around her, what is happening to the economy of the country, etc., etc. So labor also became something that grounded my analysis in the gendered ways in which labor by men and women was being read, in the sense that a lot of I found more and more that as I try to understand these structures, I found that women's labor in the theater was often read in affective terms, in not in terms of efficiency, not in terms of as not in fact as labor, but as a kind of love or nurture. And I spend a lot of time actually looking at that in the third chapter, trying to understand that. It was much later that I began to also sort of read much more deeply about social reproduction theories, the work of Titi Bhattacharjo, the work of, you know, in fact, even Silvia Federici. I mentioned these people, these theories briefly in my preface and introduction, but I thought it best not to kind of reformulate that entire chapter based on that. But those questions are already there. What is care? What is nurture? How is labor gendered and invisibilized? How is kind of a reading of labor as love something that ultimately erases the whole spectacle of women's labor from this story altogether? So that was one very important question. The other, say for example, a sort of big framework that I use in the fourth chapter, especially in analyzing Uppaldat's work, I actually use the Gramscian framework. I look at Gramsci's idea of the organic intellectual, Gramsci's ideas about labor, intellectual labor and physical labor, who the organic intellectual is, because I found that in Uppaldat's plays, he was like almost like a leitmotif, the figure of the organic intellectual and the woman as an organic intellectual was appearing, especially from the late 50s to the late 60s. So I look at that. So that's another important analytic framework that I use. And in the last chapter, I go towards actually looking at the question of agency and problematizing what we understand agency to be. And there I have gone towards the work of Talal Asad, looking at whether it's possible to think of pain in agentive terms. I've also looked at the work of Saba Mahmood looked at how, in fact, we can think of norm, self-actualization, and resistance in different ways within a kind of revolutionary context. So I look at the play Antigone, Anouilh's, the French version of the play written in 1944, produced in 1944, and that was the play that was performed during the emergency in Kolkata. And I use these theorists in order to understand Antigone's role as a female political agent in a world where a woman is not allowed to be political. And I look at how we can differently understand within Antigone's passion the possibilities of political agency itself. So that's something very complicated, which I summarize very badly, which happens in chapter 5. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are many more, but this is what I can remember, right?
Right. I'm sure there's many more, but it's enough for the interview's purpose. So, Trina, you do refer to the problematic position of the women performers in Bengali group theatre. So how do you look at it in relation to the IPTA and the Progressive Writers Association?
I think I've already somewhat answered this question. I think with the IPTA, I spend a long time in the introduction as well as in the first chapter talking about the Indian People's Theatre Association. And there are two primary concerns that I have, which I think remain relevant to the working of the group theatres afterwards in Bengal. One is the relationship between politics and culture, right? And in a sense, in Bengal, in the performance of Nobanno, written by Bijon Bhattacharjo and directed by both Shombhu Mitra and Bijon Bhattacharjo, which was first performed in October 1944 in the Srirangam Theatre in Kolkata. It was meant to raise money for the People's Relief Committee for the famine that had taken Bengal over. And this has been written about, I mean, the facts of the of this history have been written about again and again. I mean, there's so much work around it. But what I was trying to look at is how this there is almost this kind of seamless coming together by most accounts of art and politics in the staging of Navanna, where political workers and you know theatre workers come together. In fact, some become theatre workers for the first time because they see this play as nation's work, as working for the people. Say, for example, Tripti Mitra, who becomes an actress for the first time in her life, not because she wants to be an actress, but because she thinks this as an extension of her work for the people who are dying on the streets of Kolkata every day. So during the day, she runs the Longar Khana, and the night, she's performing Navanna. And this, it's a time that is traumatic, but it's also a time that is magical. I often refer back to how Malarika Sinha Roy, in her book on Naukshalbari and women, uses the term magic moment. So these are times of great crisis and difficulty, but these are also times of great, you know, struggle and optimism at the same time. And that's very, very difficult to explain. So this is the time when Navanna takes place. This is a time of a certain kind of a magnitude in terms of artistic and political lives that becomes possible. Which predictably, of course, in a few years begins to break apart, begins to fall apart, because, you know, that kind of intensity and, you know, the magic moment is in fact a moment. It cannot be prolonged forever. So the thing is, I was trying to understand the kind of relationship between politics and culture that is imagined here. The first iteration of the idea of a people's theatre as a politically committed theatre where artists and workers in the theater. This is the first time the imagination of the person in the theater as a worker, you know, political worker. So political worker and a cultural worker would be professionally committed to a theater, a whole timer in the theater, sort of almost driven by the work of the People's Theatre, like it was a mission. But in fact, the theatre will be a non-commercial space. So a self-sustaining theatre, which was in fact non-commercial, not dependent on the market or on the state, but where an artist was in fact a whole-timer, sustaining himself or herself completely from the theatre. It's almost an impossible idea if you think about it. And Malini Bhattacharya writes about this, that it was clear to those who could see that this kind of a theatre could only be economically sustainable or even be sustainable as a political idea in a world where, in fact, capitalism had already collapsed, where we had actually reached a classless society. That was not the case. But the odd aspiration was that in order for the future that is imagined to come, one needs to begin to live as if it is already here. So in a sense, it was an idea in the future that needed to be actualized in the present. And that I thought was a fascinating idea. And it's an impossible idea, but it's an aspiration that drives theater workers in the group theater for the next 3 or 4 decades. That leads people like Utpal Dutt to lease Minerva Theatre, or Jitesh Bandyopadhyay to lease Rangona Theatre, to make this theatre a full-time work. And sometimes they fail, sometimes they succeed, but this drives the theatre. And the other question was, of course, the question of gender and sexuality. How the female comrade was being imagined in the IPTA. And, you know, I try to do an analysis of, you know, what is the relationship of this politics to sexuality, to gender, to the gendering of the female comrade? Yeah.
Right. So you do talk about K.R. Chakraborty and, you know, what does it mean to be a full-time actress in group theatre in the eras of the 1960s and 70s of Kolkata? So if you could, you know, throw some light on the life of a professional woman artist and how it is shaped.
Yeah, so I think I've already kind of touched upon various points of this, answer. So then if we were just talking about this impossible idea, this idea that theater could be a non-commercial enterprise, but something that does not depend on the commercial imperatives of the market, does not sell out, so to say, and it doesn't actually depend on state funding either. So it remains ideologically pure, but also kind of manages to sustain itself financially. And like I said, this idea drives, directors who are deeply committed to this politics to various kinds of financial and artistic experiments. And one of them is Ajitesh Bandyopadhyay's Nandikar in the 60s, where he finds, he wants, and he writes again and again in his essays that it's impossible to imagine theater as a part-time occupation for the middle class, who sees theater as well as politics as a kind of ornament, you know, which you can wear and take off at will. And he says it should not be like that. He feels that theater should be a full-time passionate commitment for the theater worker in the group theater. And it is because of this reason that, and of course, I mean, Kia Chakraborty, who's training under him, who's also his collaborator, his friend, looks up to him, is, like many other theater workers, is deeply convinced by this idea. And so this is the story that the chapter tells. I've already talked about the theoretical framework of this chapter. So she gives up her job as a full-time professor of Scottish Church, and Scottish Church. She teaches English literature. She gives up her job and becomes a full-time worker for Nandikar, and of course she's unable to sustain herself financially. And so I look at it's almost a kind of a tragic myth. Kia Chakraborty's death in 1977. She took up a role as an extra in a commercial Bengali film because she needed the money for her mother's treatment, and she dies during an accident during the shooting. And this has been talked about again and again, and she becomes, most kind of tragic deaths with artists dying young, she becomes almost a myth for the Bangla theater world. But I was actually trying to understand what the systemic causes of this kind of end. The fact that she was more and more being pushed to a corner financially and otherwise to a state of absolute, a precarious condition, and a state in a life of very, very hard labor where she was working all the time for the theater. And this labor was not even recognized by her own self as labor. She constantly read this as love for theater group. So I was trying to understand this life in the context of the questions of the economic structures of the group theater, the state of the economy of the country, unemployment, the precarious conditions of most artists, and especially a woman whose labor is constantly kind of erased from a story where she is seen as a nurturer. So I argue that Kia is remembered as an actress, as an exceptional actress, as a good human being, as a very loving friend and sister, and but the story of her great efficiency as an organizer, as a publicist, as a producer for many of Nandikar's plays actually becomes far less seen in this history. So this is part of my overarching argument that in the years between the 1950s and the 1980s, you mostly remember women as actresses primarily. It does not matter what work they're doing, you see them primarily as actresses. But the work of organizing and creating and thinking, and especially technical work, always seems to be relegated to men. It takes many years for the woman as organizer to return to this history. I mean, when she's doing the work of organizing, her work to be recognized as such, it takes a lot of time. So I think these questions, the impossibility of a woman like Kia Chakraborty actualizing herself in the conditions in which she was working in the theater, achieving fulfillment as an artist and as a passionate worker seemed almost impossible, which is why the larger systemic tragedy the reasons for her death needed to be understood in terms of labor, which is what I've tried to do. Yeah.
Right. So last question, Trina. I know you've already said that, you know, you've touched upon it in the conclusion, but what would some of the fundamental transformations that have taken place in the Bengali group theater in the 1980s and 1990s be?
I think I've already said most of this in the beginning. So yes, I think it for the 1990s onwards, as with the rest of the country and any kind of, you know, artistic endeavor, things changed drastically. You know the reasons why, because the kind of the possibility of the possibilities of the market change, entirely. But also, I think now, if you look at the theatre groups in Bengal, which are as numerous and as active as they used to be, perhaps more, there are, in fact, some very, I mean, at least in Kolkata, some very fundamental changes, I mean, overall. For example, it is very common now for actors and actresses, performers, to perform in more than one group. So in the case of Kea or Tripti Mitra would have required asking for permission, the fact that one was actually, if you were a member of a certain group, you belonged to that group and you performed in productions by that group, that is no longer the norm for everyone. There are many, many performers who now perform, you know, in sort of as freelance actors in numerous groups, depending on the production. Sometimes groups, in fact, don't function regularly but come together under a director when a particular production is being planned. There are many more theater festivals than before. So in a sense, the actor, once they have achieved a certain kind of success, have many options to kind of perform in very many different kinds of groups. It's much more common for actors to actually also perform in television serials and, add to their, supplement their income in that way. And it is not looked upon with that kind of ideological criticism as it was before. I am not going to say whether I think this is a positive or a negative change. I do not have the moral or the scholarly right to do that, because I haven't studied this, or I don't even believe in kind of making that kind of a moral judgment. But the thing is, this has happened. I feel that this changes the modality of ideological commitment that we had seen in these years, and this almost impossible desire. So, and also it's much more common for actors to demand at least a little bit of payment for the work that they're doing. I mean, especially when they've kind of become a little, you know, they've been a little successful, they're senior, they do get paid. It's not a lot of money, but it's much more common for actors to be paid. So in that sense, the group theater model or the group theater infrastructure is no longer as all consuming and all pervasive as it used to be. And if you look at it historically, it was inevitable given the changes economically that took place, especially post 1990. In Bengal, of course, but of course all over India, the whole circulation of capital is very, very different. I'm not saying in any sense that the lives of theatre workers is very easy now, and you know, there are many, many different kinds of theatre groups which try to function in, even now, without state funding, even now, outside the proscenium, in different kinds of circumstances, and their lives remain just as precarious. But this is also true for a lot of actors, that they work as freelance artists and they ask for payment. Yeah.
Right. So thank you, Trina, for the very engaging and wonderful conversation. I would like to thank you for taking time out to do this interview. And,
Thank you, Rituponda, for reading the book, for asking such excellent questions, and it was an absolute pleasure talking to you.